Lorena here from Everything's Canceled podcast. Herman and I hope you've been enjoying our show. The best way to support us right now is to subscribe to our Patreon for some exclusive episodes and more at patreon.com/everythingscanceled. And don't forget, there's only one L in canceled. And shop our new merch on our Shopify. The Shopify is everythingscanceled.myshopify.com. Now let's get to today's show. You're listening to Everything's Canceled podcast with your hosts,
Herman
and Lorena. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you're listening to right now and follow us on Instagram at Everything's Canceled podcast. In each episode, we discuss topics in detail that could be triggering for some listeners, so please listen with care.
All content provided in this podcast is for general information and entertainment purposes only. Any copyrighted content reproduced in this podcast is done so in accordance with Section 107 of the Copyright Act, allowing fair use and is not an infringement of copyright. Any information discussed referring to specific incidents are allegations only, unless proven otherwise in a court of law. Due to the changing nature of laws, rules, and regulations, the hosts make no representations to the accuracy or completeness of any information in this podcast and will not be liable for any errors, omissions, nor the availability of this information, for any losses, injuries, or damage from the display or use of this information.
Welcome to Everything's Canceled. This is part two of our Nickelodeon saga. But who's canceled this week, Herman?
Nickelodeon and Brian Peck.
So this is part two. Last episode, we talked about Dan Schneider and all of Dan Schneider's victims.
His creations and his victims and the environment he created at Nickelodeon on the mini shows that he created for Nickelodeon.
Yeah, but I'm kind of ready to leave Dan Schneider in the last episode and move on to Brian Peck. I want to start out this episode saying, like, I'm kind of hoping to find more on Brian Peck. I really want to take Brian Peck down. Herman, you're also a little suspicious that he probably has more victims than Drake. And
that's definitely one of the first and biggest questions that came to mind when I think about this story and I think about Brian Peck, because Drake Bell is the victim who came forward and
years later, too.
Yeah, many years later. But it seems very likely or possible that there could have been other victims. And there are definitely question marks raised about who they could be.
I mean, what are the chances that Drake is the only victim? Surely that happens where, like, a perpetrator like Brian Peck focuses in on one child and is so obsessed and then gets caught before he ever has any other victims. He seemed so experienced and calculated in the way that he groomed and targeted Drake that I can't let it go. I think that we're probably going to hear other victims come forward. That's my bet. I don't have anything like juicy to be like, oh, I think it's going to be this person or anything like that, really. But it just seems almost damn near impossible that Drake's the only victim to me.
It's a big question mark over this story. Is Drake Bell Brian Peck's only victim?
And there's got to be so many factors that went into why Drake kept this to himself the way that he did. Some are personal, but some have got to be like Hollywood influence that would also keep another victim quiet.
He really felt like his career would be on the line to come forward, you know?
I think there's a lot of things like with his relationship with his parents and being a boy and the era and all of that. Let's just dive in.
Do we want to talk about who Brian Peck is?
Yeah, I guess we should start off with who Brian Peck is. We have no relationship with... I didn't know who he was before this, right?
No, and I think that's another reason people want to talk about Dan, because we all know the shows he made. We know who Dan was because, like, we're all really familiar with his material. But Brian Peck was an actor, so we did know him from working on screen. He acted in a lot of stuff, like lots of bit parts. I looked it up, and there's nothing that, like, really stands out. He's in the X-Men movies and a bunch of stuff. But then he became a dialogue coach who became known for working with young actors and helping them. I mean, what does a dialogue coach do?
I'm kind of under the impression that he helps them, like, execute their lines and humor and faces that they make and the way they express themselves and just sort of fine-tune
how they deliver.
That was the word I was looking for. Help them memorize their lines. And it also seems like, we're going to get into this, it seems like they spend a lot of time with these actors, not just correcting them on the spot, but training them behind closed doors, which really does invite opportunities to be alone with these kids.
Exactly.
Because there's just a lot of time. Like, we can all say we wouldn't leave our kid alone with an adult like this, but when they've been your boss for a long time and you're like, okay, I have other kids. I need to do other things. This is my kid's job. My kid has a job that's unconventional. So I'm going to do unconventional things. Am I going to sit and watch them recite lines for 4 hours right now? Or am I going to go run errands while they do this? They spend a lot of one-on-one time together behind the stage.
Yeah, I've never worked on a movie or a TV set before, so I don't know exactly what a dialogue coach does. I can kind of infer a little bit based on that title, but what I can tell based on what we know about Brian Peck and Drake Bell's relationship and some of these others is that it definitely involves working one-on-one with your client, and they work together a lot.
Something that's interesting, like a side note, Drake was offered an opportunity to be on a different documentary a few years ago. He never names that documentary, but I think it's safe to assume it's the documentary called Open Secret, and you can find it on YouTube. I actually really hope that we get the opportunity to do an episode on it because I got deep into it and it's even darker than this one, in my opinion. A lot of the actors I was talked about was kind of the era before the Drake situation. It seemed to be 80s and 90s stuff more than 90s and 2000s. And it's all the exact same experiences where these dialogue coaches spent a lot of alone time with these kids. And that was very normal. And the parents were encouraged to leave these kids alone with them. And the industry trains you up when you go to these trainings where they teach you how to be a child actor. They're like, you should go get your headshots. And should your mom have your headshots when you walk in? No, you should. Once you are 8 years old, you are your own boss. I don't want you to say, oh, my mommy has them in her purse. I need to go get them. You need to already have them and be prepared to be in this room alone with me. You are an adult. They are training these parents to believe that they can treat their children like adult employees and just leave them alone. So these kids are being groomed to be alone with these dialogue coaches and whoever else, which is, I think, a huge part of what makes these kids in Hollywood really vulnerable.
They talk about how the parents are always supposed to be with them on set, but that in the kind of lax environment that takes place on a lot of Nickelodeon sets, and I'd imagine this happens on a lot of other sets too, where at a certain point they're being pressured to work more and more, to work more hours. It's just not really like feasible to have your parent in the room with you for every single thing that goes on. So while the parents are supposed to be with their children who are working on these sets at all times, it doesn't really always happen. It definitely didn't really always happen in like on the All That set.
I kind of got the impression that there was kind of like a boardroom with snacks for parents to hang out together while the kids, so it's like the parents were there in the same building,
like a green room or something,
but not necessarily in the same room. Also, like, people don't acknowledge this. They're like, oh my God, they would leave their kids alone on set. People leave their kids alone with teachers in schools 8 hours a day and you don't think twice. We leave our kids alone with people. I think there's some parents in the documentary that I'm like, wow, I can't believe you did some of this. But also, like, you have to look at this whole picture. Like, when they tell you it was normal, it felt okay to leave their kids alone in these situations, it's because parents feel okay leaving their kids alone at school every day. It's something, it's part of life, leaving your kids with other adults. I also consider the time in that we now know today, like, I'm a parent now, I've got young kids. I came from the generation where this stuff was starting to come out. I'm the generation that's constantly warned to not leave your kids alone. Maybe don't have sleepovers. Maybe don't do these things. This generation didn't have the generation before them telling these things. This was what led to a lot of stranger danger, was the things that happened before 2000.
Yeah, well, you talked about the previous documentary that kind of talks about a little bit about what the environment was like in Hollywood leading up to this time period. And, you know, rumors are, allegations are that a lot of these same things were taking place throughout that entire time. It's not like it was a new thing.
Yeah.
The other thing that we should talk about when we talk about Brian Peck is he did appear on All That as a fairly infamous character known as Pickle Boy. You remember the Pickle Boy sketches?
Pickle Boy.
Is this the glory hole one?
Yes.
And he's the character of that?
Yeah, he plays Pickle Boy.
Pickle Boy. His pickles taste bad.
And Pickle Boy was a recurring character on all that. And there's some odd lines about Pickle. Obviously, Pickle Boy, he gives people pickles. He's obsessed. There's a line that they say, he's Pickle Boy. He likes to hurt and tease pickles.
Pickle Boy likes to hurt and tease pickles.
It's very odd. And so Pickle Boy, played by Brian Peck, was, like I said, a recurring character. And he often appeared in scenes with the celebrity guest who was on all that. And it usually involved something about giving them a pickle, like the one that they show in the documentary that is particularly strange, perverted, I guess. The one that features Ray Romano. And Ray Romano is trapped in his dressing room at all that.
I don't think I caught that was him. Maybe I did.
He's complaining about how he's starving and has nothing to eat. And Pickle Boy happens to be walking outside Ray Romano's dressing room that also happens to have a, like, open deadbolt hole in the door. And so Pickle Boy slides a pickle through the hole in the door that Ray Romano is happy to eat.
And we
know what this is.
It zooms in on the pickle going into the hole, like a glory hole. And then Ray Romano, who I forgot that was him, eats the pickle. And it's like literally Pickle Boy's just going around like offering his dick to everyone is essentially what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Pickle Boy, the best pickle boy in the world.
Okay, I had to break that down for anyone who couldn't get that image, I guess.
Figure out, the Freudian imagery of fucking Pickle Boy.
When I had to listen back
Let us analyze that one for you.
When I had to listen back to my voice on the last podcast where I'm like, nose boy, and it was not a nose. It was a dick and balls. Dick and balls. And I was like, okay, I need to lay off the podcast microphone here.
No shit.
No shit. Sorry, I was adding effect.
Now you know.
We'll be right back.
But you still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man. I'm trying to get them on there. We all artists, man. We gonna have this like,
bro, me and my man Kai, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now. I gotta lie, we play with this shit right now for real. I gotta lie.
Don't play with it, take that shit serious.
And so from all that, Brian moves on to working on The Amanda Show.
I'm assuming that most people who have found this podcast probably know Drake Bell and the shows and have maybe even seen the documentary. But I have to talk for like the people who are coming in blind here. But Drake Bell, he was on all that, right?
I don't think so. No, I think he started on the Amanda Show. He had a bunch of other little roles before that.
Right,
though.
And he had already kind of idolized Amanda Bynes because she was on all that, and he watched that as a kid. He started on The Amanda Show, which came from that, and then went on to Drake and Josh, got his own spinoff. So this story happens from The Amanda Show
to the beginning
to the
of
window
Drake and
before
Josh.
Drake and Josh. Yeah. So this is that time period before that.
Kind of like.
So his career is really taking off. This is right when his career is taking off to about to really take off.
Yeah, he's about to basically get his big, big break from on TV to having his own show.
Yeah, and he's working with Dan Schneider and Brian Peck.
Mm-hmm.
They know he's going to be the next star. Like, he is going to be the preteen heartthrob, and they know that.
Can we just talk about Drake for like 1 second? When I was watching Drake's interview, I say in the last episode, I'd never seen Drake and Josh or The Amanda Show. So I didn't really know who Drake Bell was. So this was like kind of a new person to me. Amanda Bynes too. And when I was watching his interview, looking at his face, he reminded me of so many different other people and so many things. One thing that really came to mind is Corey Feldman. I kept thinking about Corey Feldman And that brings us back to kind of like the stories of people who are child stars who came before that. And I mean, I don't know if maybe they just kind of look similar, or they've been through the same kind of stuff, or maybe they go to the same plastic surgeon. But there's something that's really common about all these children. And Drake says it himself, where he talks about how he had this dream. He had this dream, I want to make people laugh. Just like Amanda, like so many of these other kids who have this like thing that they want to be. They see, you know, they have their favorite stars, famous actors and actresses from the past that they idolize and they like really look up to, and they have these big dreams, and they're like, they are really kind of like these special children too. Not that they're better than other kids or anything, but they're these kids who have this special set of traits and characteristics that make them the kid that always wants to be funny, that wants to stand out, that wants to entertain everybody and be the center of attention, and also the ones who are really capable of doing it and being so funny and having that light shine on them when they do that.
It's interesting because I have the opposite experience, that like I loved Drake. He was my preteen heartthrob. So I watched all those shows, loved him, and it was actually really heartbreaking for me to see him in this interview as an adult. I have a complicated relationship with Drake in that I loved him on TV and thought he was so cute. Then years later, heard about his court case where he was convicted of child endangerment because he was talking to a minor. We're going to get into the details of that. And I never looked deeper into that. I was like, oh, great, another celebrity I love did something shitty, cool. And then moved on. And then I saw him here and it's like, okay, Drake's about the same age as me. We have some similar trauma. And I was like looking in his eyes and I was like, one, that's a man who's been through a lot. And two, he is just now opening up these wounds. And if I have ever seen it, that is a man who is currently in therapy right now. He has therapy words. He has heartbreak in his eyes. He's very genuine, very sweet. And you just want to reach through the screen and just like hold him.
He says specifically that I have never talked about these things outside of therapy.
And you can tell. You can tell. Mm-hmm.
It's written all over him.
Yeah. He's squirming in his chair too. You know, one thing that I saw that was really gut-wrenching for me is when he does talk about the abuse that he went through.
The way he describes it is...
His body language. Yeah. They try to get him engaged, like, to talk about some of the details within his comforts. And he kind of squirms in his chair. And you see him cross his legs and like clench his bottom half, like he's remembering the pain and he's replaying it in his head. And I saw that and I was just like, God, this poor kid. And he just says, imagine the worst things that someone can do to a child, and that is what happened to me, the worst things. And it does flash to the court papers and it gives descriptive words.
Details
that you're just like,
charges, yeah.
Fuck, this poor fucking kid, he went through the thing. No ifs, ands, or buts, this poor kid was raped.
I think that everybody knows a kid like that.
Yeah.
Or maybe you have a kid like that. Maybe you were a kid like that. Maybe these kids who just, they have this very simple thing that they want to be, and it's just, I want to sing, I want to dance, I want people to pay attention to me. And the way that impulse and those special kind of characteristics, the things that make these kids special, are exploited and degraded is just really sad and hurtful to watch.
I remember watching him on Drake and Josh, which was after everything that happened to him, and he was so happy, and you're just like, oh, like how could he have been broken? It's like these were his happy moments. This is what he used as an escape. But it's interesting because like back to watching him in this interview, I don't know about you, but it's like, okay, here's a 30 something year old man and all I see is a little boy right now. And I think when we have these things happen to them, like I'm 30, I have trauma, I can walk through life looking like a 30-year-old woman. And I can even right now flippantly say I went through trauma and I look just fine. But when I have to sit down and talk about it and someone's looking at me, I think they see like the broken little girl in me. And that is what I saw in Drake. I was looking in on that where it's just like, it's very real. And I mean, obviously we have the court papers to corroborate, but if we didn't, we could look at him and be like, this is honest, this is true, this is pain, this is what this looks like.
How many of these child stars make it to adulthood successfully, to having adult careers successfully?
He certainly
didn't.
It's
not a lot of them. And one of the other actors from all that, Kyle Sullivan, he talks about the way that all of this affected him, and he describes it is that he became disillusioned immediately. And you really see that all over them. And I think it mirrors the same process that we kind of all go through, this like process of disillusionment, of alienation, of like whatever you're going to call it. You know what I mean? Where you become disillusioned with all these things that you may have once thought were good in your life. Things that, you know, the more that you learn about them, we are kind of experience that same process with all of these people who brought us the entertainment that we loved at one time too, when they're canceled or when we go through this process of like learning these things about them that change everything about it. You know, it's like so many of us loved these shows. And then when you find out the things that the people who made them had to go through and the kind of like system that's set up to exploit these children, it makes you think about it very differently.
Yeah. That's why our podcast is called Everything's Canceled.
Exactly.
And how everything in our lives are being ruined because they're being tainted with the truth of these dark things. And it's everywhere. It's out there in the news or on our TV shows. It's in our homes. It's in our real lives. And here we are. Everything's fucking canceled. We talked about who Brian Peck is, and we were talking about who Drake is. One more thing that I want to say about Drake that is interesting and comes up in his story is that he wasn't just an actor, he was a musician. And he wrote his own music, and he's been playing music since he was a kid. And it's interesting because recently on his TikTok, he's been going back and playing the songs that he wrote at this time of being abused. And no one knew that he was being abused. And these songs are just about him being broken and the things that are going on. He does the theme song for Drake and Josh. He does the theme song for iCarly. He writes great music. He has a new hit out called I Can Relate. And we'll talk about that, but definitely check it out.
I kinda relate. Drake's career is
taking off. He's working with Brian Peck. And this is where Brian Peck starts infiltrating himself into every aspect of Drake's life.
Yeah. Drake is working on the Amanda Show. He's performing in his new band. Things are going really well for him. And Brian Peck is somebody who he's spending a lot of time with.
And this is right when Drake turns from age 14 to 15. And what's really interesting about Brian Peck is that he throws a lot of parties, which sounds a little bit like Diddy. And he throws these parties for excuses to celebrate anything, right? But he's an adult making parties for these children actors because his employees are children. And he has them all at the house and he throws these big parties.
Yeah, all of the kids talk about going to parties at Brian Peck's house, and they describe Brian Peck's house too, and it's interesting. They say that he has a room that has all Hollywood memorabilia and all kinds of cool things that he's collected. He's got video games and stuff like that at his house.
It reminds me of Michael Jackson and his house. It's like his own fantasy world. That's very interesting. Why wouldn't kids want to come over to his carnival house?
Brian Peck also seems to exhibit some of that same type of arrested development thing where he is like a perpetual teenager himself.
Yeah. I would be so curious to know what traumas are in Brian Peck's life. What made Brian Peck the way he is?
But it seems like, you know, parties, having parties at his house, parties with the cast of all of these shows, these young teenagers. This is like a totally normalized thing. I don't want to say it's normal, but it's something that happens often in this group. And Kyle Sullivan again tells a story about being in one of the rooms at Brian Peck's house, and he has a painting on the wall of a clown. Kyle's like, you know, what's this? And Brian is very excited to tell him about it because this is a painting that was painted by infamous serial killer John Wayne Gacy.
Who, his victims were all teenage boys.
He murdered young boys. Yeah,
he murdered young boys.
And so he's so excited to tell Kyle about this because not only does he have this signed painting by John Wayne Gacy, he's actually pen pals with John Wayne Gacy, and he's been like writing letters back and forth with him. And this is one of his absolute prized possessions, is that he is buddies, pen pals with John Wayne Gacy, and has this signed painting.
Yeah, it's like not significant to the story, but it's significant. You can't ignore it. You gotta acknowledge that. Maybe, like, what the fuck is that, right? I see why they put it in the documentary. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's weird.
It's weird. Are you friends with a serial killer? I'm not.
So Drake's manager is his dad, Joe Bell, and his dad has been his manager for his entire career. And his dad is interviewed in the documentary quite a bit and tells his story.
He's now America's favorite dad. He's yeah, so sweet.
He's a very, like, identifiable. You really feel his feelings. It's very cathartic.
He's this long-haired, kind of hippie-looking dad who's not afraid to cry and very sweet.
I was struck by both Drake and his candor as far as, like, the way that they tell their story and their sincerity, where it's just, it's written all over their faces. One, how true this is, and two, how much it affected their lives and them emotionally. So Joe describes a little bit about what it was like to work on set with Drake and Brian Peck. And Brian Peck would just kind of always be around Drake. They were real close. It seemed like he was always finding times to touch him that just didn't seem necessary. Like, he'd be putting on his clothes or something and Brian would help him and things. It's just like, well, why are you touching my son right now? And it's interesting because they throw that back to showing images of Brian Peck working on previous shows. And one of the shows that he worked on was Growing Pains with Leonardo DiCaprio. And they show images of the same thing where it's like he's real close. He's always touching Leo's arm. And it's just kind of like, okay.
And Leo being like 14, 15.
Yeah, they're like, okay, Leo was the hottest young actor in Hollywood at the time.
Hottest as in popular, not...
Yeah.
Just to be clear, I just didn't wait.
Well, I mean, he was certainly a heartthrob as well.
For a young girl.
For young people who are attracted to Leo, I guess. We don't want to include the Brian Pecks of the world in there, but I guess so. So when Joe, Drake's dad, would bring this up with the other family members, like the other parents or other people on set, he said that he would get the same response. It was that Brian Peck, he was openly gay.
And this is right at the height of, like, a lot of gay acceptance in Hollywood. Like, we're getting, like...
early 2000s, so, like...
We've got, like, Will and Grace, we've got Ellen, we've got... You know what I mean? But it's also, like, pre-gay marriage.
It's a really precarious time, I would say, for, like, gay rights.
It's a sensitive time, for sure.
Yeah. And so, it's interesting because when Joe would bring up that he felt that he was uncomfortable... the ways that Brian seemed to be getting close to Drake, he said he felt like he was criticized and that he wasn't allowed to say anything critical about him. They'd say that, oh, well, you know that Brian's gay. Maybe you're just being homophobic. He's a touchy-feely type of guy.
Definitely at this time, people would stereotype gay people as being pedophiles. Oh, if you would be gay, you would probably touch children. So imagine, like, accusing a gay man of being... too friendly with children. It's like you're stereotyping them in the way that at the time is being talked about.
Yeah, and I think this is important to talk about. Yeah, because it kind of creates like an interesting situation where you have basically something that is often brought up as an anti-LGBTQ or like an anti-wokeness type of argument, which is that either gay people are inherently pedophiles, which we know is absolutely ridiculous, but also that the LGBTQ movement as a whole is something that harbors pedophiles or like protects pedophiles. And that's something that would be like a really common argument. And in this case, that almost seems to play out, right? Because you have Brian Peck, since he is out as openly gay, then it's like, oh, well, criticizing anything he does, maybe you're just being homophobic. But I wanted to dig a little bit more into that narrative because it might read that way on the surface, but that type of like gay panic argument, first off, to make the argument that the LGBTQ community harbors pedophiles or it is a goal of that community to try and make pedophiles or pedophilia acceptable for some reason is a ridiculous argument on its face. And I think that what you really have in this situation is you have a person who is a pedophile who's hiding behind being LGBTQ. This isn't somebody who is actually part of that community. This is somebody who is using this identity to launder what they're doing as something else.
We were just talking about this the other day, that nobody is trying to protect pedophiles. Not even the entertainment industry. We talk about it all the time. They aren't protecting pedophiles. They're protecting money. And Brian Peck mm-hmm. made them a lot of money. So there was incentive here to brush things off, because Brian Peck was very well loved, mm-hmm. like professionally. He made Nickelodeon a lot of money.
And he worked with a lot of people. And a lot of these people, they wanted to continue their careers. And they probably thought that by defending Brian Peck, that's what they needed to do. So that kind of brings me to my second point as well, where you have all of these people who are supposedly defending Brian Peck or being like, well, maybe if you're criticizing him, like, are you just being homophobic? What you really have is you have people who are posing as LGBTQ allies, but what they really are is they're collaborators. They're people who are collaborating in not only Brian Peck's offenses, but they're collaborating by creating the environment that allows him the power and the access to commit his crimes.
Right.
So instead of like, oh, these people are being allies, it's like, well, no, they're not allies, because they're actually collaborators who are hiding as allies.
It's messy and complicated. Like, I can't imagine being there in person and being like standing between Brian Peck and Joe Bell, the dad, and seeing from my perspective, if I don't know that he hurts children or anything, I'm just seeing this very nice, openly gay guy putting his arm around a kid and being friendly and being a boss. And then you have this dad being like, I think he's a creep. And you add in all of these layers. It's hard to say what you would think in the moment or what you would do, and add on the stereotypes about gay people, especially gay men, and that they're always going to hit on you. Like, a gay person must want every man and things like that. Mm. And it's like, you're stuck between
gay men are pedophiles.
Yeah. And so then you're stuck between two people, and you want to be a gay ally, but you also want to be a protector of children. You've got those two going against each other. Like, I'm not defending the people who were there. I'm just saying, in a real life experience, if you walked up on a conversation like this and this dad is telling you his concern, and then you have this gay man who's experiencing stereotyping or oppression or whatever that you think he might be experiencing as a gay person, that's a tough situation to try to judge from the outside if you don't know anything.
Yeah.
Especially if that person's your boss.
Yeah, even more so. So that takes us to, at this point, Drake describes it as Brian, he's working his way into every single aspect of his life. He worked with him on set. When Drake has concerts, Brian comes to every single concert.
No matter where it is, he travels hours mm-hmm. on like school nights.
Yeah, he's
shit.
Like, you know, if I had a concert in town, like maybe I'd expect Dan or, you know, the rest of the crew there. But Brian came to everything. He was a part of everything that I did. He worked his way into every aspect of Drake's life,
including his birthday party, mm-hmm. like we were mentioning. So Drake turns 15, which is so young. And also the age is significant when it comes to his court case, and we'll talk about that.
This but is 2001.
2001, so Drake turns 15. And it's interesting because he's having a party. It's his birthday, but Brian is the one who offers for it to be at his house. Kind of pushy.
Yeah,
he's
Brian like, convinces Drake and his family to have the party at his house.
Yeah, and it sounds like maybe his parents weren't totally on board for that, but it's his boss and is leading him to huge opportunities at this time. So they have this party. We don't really hear much about it. Doesn't seem like anything significant happened at the party, but what does happen is after the party, Drake had gotten birthday cards from everyone, and there were cards from these adults that said inappropriate things to Drake, and they don't get into specifics, so I can only guess based on like kind of how he described in the vibe, but it was like things about him being like sexy.
Yeah, I think you get the vibe as dirty shit.
I think they're just like, you're so sexy.
My guess was this. Maybe it's like, oh, you're going to be getting lots of pussy type of thing.
When we listened to the Boy Meets World podcast, where they decided to talk about this, Will Friedle and Ryder Strong, they talk about being on the set as teenage boys and the way that their crew around them would talk to them and they would tell them that they were sexy all the time mm-hmm. and things like that. So I'm imagining it's very similar. Like,
there was kind of like a bro down environment of like they were teenage boys, but they talked about sex stuff and stuff like that, like dudes.
But the boys, Will and Ryder, talk about how older women on the set were talking to them about how sexy they were.
Mm-hmm.
And they go on to marry much older women.
And definitely the girls on both that set and like the sets of these Nickelodeon shows talk about the same thing. About them like maturing and then people treating them real differently and things
like
that.
As a girl, I already assumed that that was going on, but it was interesting to hear that about Drake. So I'm imagining these cards said things like, "You're the sexiest rock star ever," things like that. But nonetheless, they were weird to Drake's dad, but not weird enough to like they didn't use any specific examples, and it wasn't the thing that blew everything up. But they were weird, and he still remembers it to this day, and it was a red flag to him, and it made him uncomfortable that his son was being seen as a sex object at his 15th birthday with all of his bosses and employees.
Yeah.
At this point, Drake is very involved with Brian, and he is spending a lot of time with Drake. As we said, Drake's dad is his manager and manages everything. His acting career is something that they had something to do together. Drake's dad had found an ad in a magazine for an audition when Drake was 9 years old. And he basically was just, "Well, I've already tried Little League with him. I've tried this. I've tried that. Nothing really clicked. I think this is something he would really like, and we can do it together. I'll take him to his auditions. I'll take him to do acting training. This will be like a dad and son thing that we do together." So his dad's been there since day one, helping him do this. Drake wanted to be in the spotlight. It was a very mutual thing between Drake and his dad. And this is when Brian starts putting into Drake's head that his dad is just after his money. He's keeping his money. He's spending his money. Your dad shouldn't be your manager. Like, not necessarily I should be your manager, but you should be listening to what I have to say, because you are going to be a huge star and your dad is going to hold you back. And he essentially convinces Drake to fire his dad as his manager and make his mom his manager.
And you have to realize, like, Brian Peck is an important guy. He's an important guy in these shows. He's an important advisor to Drake. So when he's giving Drake this advice, Drake is like, "Well, this must be good advice."
Well, and something very important going on in Drake's life at this point is also that his parents' marriage is falling apart, or has fallen apart. He is a child caught in divorce, and his dad is his manager. And if he fires his dad, who's left? His mom. And so there's this war kind of pitted between his parents. I don't know how ugly that really was, but as a kid of divorce, I know even if your parents aren't upset about something, you think you're choosing between your parents all the time. That's a very sticky situation. And I think Brian saw that as a vulnerability, and he saw his mom as the weaker person, where like, if I can just get rid of dad, who's one, suspicious of me, two, doesn't leave, he's always there with Drake, that I can maybe have a way with mom a little bit better. I might be able to manipulate the situation a little better. She seems to be the weaker one in the situation. So he convinces him to make his mom the manager, which essentially severs the relationship between Drake and his dad, because his dad is hurt. And Drake is suspicious of his dad and thinks his dad has done wrong by him with his money. And also, Drake is 15. So all the normal 15-year-old stuff with, like, my parents, parent issues, kid issues, divorce, all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Drake. And also, Drake is doing a lot of adult things as a kid. So you think you can handle a lot more freedom. He doesn't need his parents. So this is where his management switches to his mom. And what does his dad say? "Whatever makes you happy, I just want you to be happy." But he goes to his mom and he says, "Please watch Brian Peck with our son. Keep an eye on him. Keep him safe. Never leave him alone with him." And mom doesn't listen for whatever reasons. Like I said, I think it's normal to start leaving your kid alone places with people you've met before. Brian Peck probably went balls to the wall making this woman feel comfortable with
him. He was trusted, yeah, and he was manipulating them in a number of ways. And that's the way that Drake describes it happening, is that over time, "Well, doesn't it make more sense for Brian to come pick me up from Orange County to take me to LA for my auditions, and then it's going to be late for him to drive me home, so doesn't it just make sense for me to stay over the night and stay the weekend?" And those type of things just come into play, and they come into play more and more. And ultimately, that leads to Brian having a lot of access to Drake.
Yeah, we often like villainize parents who are just like, why would you leave your child with a stranger or whatever? It's something like 95 or 99% of child sexual abuse cases are done by someone who the family trusts. Brian Peck was trusted. He was not a stranger. He'd been at all the concerts. He threw his birthday party. He's been alone with him a lot and nothing's happened, right?
And he's important to his career too. You know what I mean? Like, this is somebody who they really see as having helped Drake a lot and who is going to help him as far as making the next steps in his career.
Well, and on the flip side, it's understandable why this adult would be somewhat obsessed with him, because it's not just him that's making Drake have a career. He's going to benefit off making Drake big, right? It would make sense. You're like, this guy's so invested in my kid because my kid is also going to help him make a lot of money and be big. It's a mutual relationship where they're mutually benefiting off each other. So it's not just the weirdo down the street that's all of a sudden wanting to go to your kid's concerts. No, this guy is wanting to see Drake be big because that is what he's banking on for his career. So this leads us right to the incident, the first incident. Mm-hmm. And at this point, Drake is staying the night at his house for one of those, oh, we're going to be working late, and then oh, it's late and I don't want to drive. And he talks about how, like, when he spent the night at Brian's house before, he crashes on the couch. Like, he doesn't even change his clothes. He sort of just slips his shoes off. He's sleeping in his shorts, his jeans, whatever. And he just sort of, like, falls asleep on the couch the way that teenage boys just kind of crash somewhere. So it's not like he's been made a bed or anything. He's sort of just there. And he's asleep. And, you know, not to get too graphic, but he wakes up to what is hinted and assumed to be Brian performing oral sex on him. That is, they don't say that, but it seems like that is what we can assume. And Drake is sort of frozen and in shock. I can't imagine. He can't even get a lot of the words out of his thoughts or anything. Just sort of like, there's your first sexual experience and then it's rape. There's a lot of shock and there's a lot to like process. And then add on that this is your boss and it's an adult and this is not okay. And did I say no? Should I have done something? There's so many thoughts that would go into like a little 15-year-old boy's mind who's never done anything like this before. He went home. He didn't say anything. He didn't say anything.
His description of the event really portrays the way he feels and the way it affects him. He's just like, one morning, everything changed, and I knew that my life would never be the same. And from there, he just describes the way he felt. What am I supposed to do? Like, am I supposed to go call my mom and tell her this just happened, and I'm just going to wait here for you to pick me up? He was frozen. He didn't know what to do.
Yeah,
he...
would Brian have hurt him if he's like, I'm going to call my mom, and he has to wait for this guy to take him home? He's at the mercy of this guy.
Yeah, he said, I don't drive. I don't know how to leave. Like, I'm trapped.
If he hints that he's going to get him in trouble, does he hurt him? Does he threaten him? Does he take his job? And then there's embarrassment and shame and awkwardness. He's a 15-year-old boy, and he's been sexually abused, and there's just a lot of layers. So this kind of increases the obsession of Brian toward Drake. And I don't know if he was expecting it to not happen again, or if he kind of knew it would happen again. I don't really know. He doesn't get into like the evolvement from the first incident to the second incident or how many times it happened.
No.
But it seems like it keeps happening however many times.
As escalation. Escalation, and that basically from there the abuse got worse and worse.
Got worse and worse every time that this happened.
He does describe the abuse, not the specific incidences, but he does describe it as both extensive, and he uses the words pretty brutal.
What we do know is that there was forceful penetration and things like that. He was raped. He was penetrated with objects.
There was video. There's a lot of things.
It's very true when he says, imagine the worst things. That is what happened. That is not an exaggeration. And I don't think we need to like...
extensive, according to him.
Yeah, I don't think we need to imagine or go any further. But it's relevant to know how horrific it is because of when the court case does happen, which takes a minute to happen. Because Drake doesn't tell anyone. What happens is Drake gets a girlfriend.
Yeah.
And I kind of put myself in that position just trying to like think about wow, this is all happening to him. He's being sexually abused by a man and this huge secret. And he's going through the evolution of his first girlfriend. And like, is he thinking about having sex with her and like losing his virginity? And he's having to face this new intimate relationship with a girl his own age. And he's going through these first experiences that leads us to this night where he's hanging out at his girlfriend's house, yeah, and he's having dinner with her family. And he is on the couch and his phone is blowing up by his abuser.
Yeah, he's talking about how he's in this early relationship and he's like, well, I get a girlfriend and we're spending all our time together. I went over to her house. I was there all the times. The abuse isn't really continuing just because he's spending all the time with his new girlfriend, which is something that teenagers do, you know?
Yeah, essentially this girlfriend is in the way of Brian Peck. And I think he's starting to feel Drake pull away. And I'm sure as an abuser, that's going to bring panic, right? You're going to be like, is he pulling away because he's going to tell someone? Is he pulling away? Like, who knows what goes up in his twisted mind? Does he think Drake is interested in him? Does he think that he's in a relationship with Drake? We can only imagine, right? But he's feeling Drake distant and pulling away, and he's not answering his calls. And he's sitting there at dinner on the couch with his girlfriend's family, and the phone is just going off over and over and over. Brian will not stop calling, and he keeps ignoring it, hanging it up. And his girlfriend's mom kind of takes notice and is just like, why is this? I know he's your boss, but like, why is this?
Why is this adult man calling this teenage boy over and over? Why is he power calling you like this? That is not normal.
And what it is that happened this night is that Brian was wanting to take Drake to Disneyland, which is like just the ultimate grooming thing. Just like, can you get any more stereotypical, you know? And Drake had double booked. He had made plans with his girlfriend, forgot he needed to go to Disneyland with this 40-year-old dude, and was just like, sorry, I double booked, but I want to be with my girlfriend. And Brian is just not having it. He's not letting go. So his girlfriend's mom pulls him into the kitchen and is just like, what's up?
Why is this dude calling you over and over?
Why is this dude calling you? Like, is something going to happen? And she calls Drake's mom up and is like, I think you need to put Drake in therapy because I'm worried something is going to happen to him. That was kind of the stance she took. If something hasn't already happened, something is going to happen. This guy is a creep. She sort of like hands the situation off to Drake's mom. And he goes and he talks to a therapist and they sort of like conclude like, yeah, it's great that we had this talk and before anything happened, great. And that was the end of that. Drake didn't say things had already happened. So he does eventually call his mom.
He describes having like a breaking point
where he comes clean
and like tells his mom like this happened.
Yeah, he blurts it all out. And she immediately calls the police. So, like, credit to her. And they begin the investigation.
And Drake describes it as being really traumatic. He says that, you know, he has to go through the whole process of describing in detail every single thing that happened to him to two complete strangers. Part of the investigation involves him calling Brian Peck and attempting to solicit a confession from him. And he describes the whole scene of them sitting in his house with a black landline telephone with a cassette recorder plugged into it and the detective sitting there with their headphones on, and he has to call up Brian Peck and start talking to him and get him to confess, which he does. He gets Brian Peck to launch into a full confession and say all of these things that are recorded.
And he keeps saying like,
yeah, even while being
suspicious. Is anyone
listening? Yeah, is this being recorded?
Yeah. And to time this is right when Drake had already signed the contract to be doing Drake and Josh. It hasn't begun, but he knows who he's going to be working with and for, and Brian Peck is supposed to be part of Drake and Josh. It's Dan's show, but I believe Brian Peck was supposed to continue working with him as his dialogue coach.
Yeah,
so this is all right before the show begins. He hasn't filmed anything yet.
Yeah, he describes there as being kind of a large gap in time between the Amanda show and the beginning of Drake and Josh filming.
I want to say it's like a year. Like, kind of this is all happening
happens in that time.
So to be noted here, remember that this relationship with his dad is sort of broken at this point. I don't know how much he's seeing him, but there's tension between him and his dad because He's fired him as his manager. He's insisted to his dad, I can do this on my own. I don't need you. I don't trust you with my money. Like, whatever conversations had ensued. They still love each other, but I don't think they see each other much or talk much. Plus, Drake is working a lot and he's got a girlfriend. So as the court case begins, the only person who is in court with him is his mom and brother, because he actually never tells his dad that this happened.
Yeah, because Drake is a minor at the time that this abuse takes place, his identity is kept secret as a John Doe. And so nobody really knows who Brian Peck's victim is.
But they do know that he is being charged with this. Yeah. That is the news that's breaking in Hollywood. Brian has been accused of sexually assaulting a child.
And some of the other people who are on those shows talk about being on the show, and they say that they were just kind of taken aside one day and they were told, like, well, you know, did anything ever happen? And they were just kind of expected to confess right there. But they never knew any of the details about what had happened or who the victim was or any of that.
Yeah, they're just they like, just Brian Peck won't day be working Brian was here. Gone. Yeah, Brian's gone. He's not going to be working here. Did anything happen with you guys? And everyone across the board said no. And they just said, okay, good, moving on.
And Drake says that nobody knows it's him. So he says he's getting phone calls like, oh, did you hear about Brian Peck? Did you hear about all this? He doesn't really tell anybody until he gets a phone call from Dan. And Dan is
Dan
like, well,
yeah. Or Dan, he doesn't know, but he asks him.
He's like, was this you? And Drake, because he feels really comfortable with Dan, he knows Dan so well, he tells Dan, like, yes, this was me. I was the victim here. And, you know, what Drake says about Dan is that Dan was really supportive, that Dan was kind of was his ally through this time. But what we also know is that nobody else that he was working with found out about this.
No, Dan, he told one of his hairdressers or something, and that was it.
Yeah, Dan had this information, but nobody who they worked with had it.
And
it
I'm suspicious that maybe, secret. Like, I mean, Dan may have not even had the information. He may have just kind of guessed and then confirmed it with him.
Yeah.
But Brian and Dan knew each other. And also, I want to point out, because the internet tried to come after Drake for this, Drake in no way defends Dan against the victims who have come forward about Dan.
Totally.
He's just honest in that he doesn't know. So mm-hmm. his experience with Dan is different. In no way does he say he doesn't believe the victims or support them. He seems to be very supportive of their situation. His experience with Dan is that he was the only adult to support him in this time.
He did make the comment about whether Dan and Amanda Bynes had an inappropriate relationship, but what he said was that he never witnessed anything explicit that showed him that, but then he also qualified that by saying, I was going through a lot of stuff at the time, so I never saw anything specific, and so I can't speak to that. And I was just going through my own stuff at the time.
Just as no one saw it with him either, because yep. he went to work and he smiled and he got it done and he wasn't abused on the job. And he's asked, you know, if he's spoken to Amanda since Amanda Bynes' kind of downfall. And he says no, that like he really loved and admired Amanda when they were kids, but he's never like caught up with her or asked her how she's doing or like messaged her on social media, like ever, that they have not spoken. So when asked about his feelings about Dan or Amanda or anything, he's saying factually, I don't know anything. And also that it would not be wise or appropriate for him to make assumptions or guesses on anything, because hello, that's, you can't do that.
So, well, what happens is that Brian is charged with 11 charges of sexual abuse, of child sexual abuse, and he's arrested, and this ultimately leads to a court case against him.
I think that either included in those 11 charges or separate, there's also charges of other things that come with that, other related charges that come with that.
Yeah, there are 11 total charges relating to child sexual abuse.
Which is a lot, considering what he's sentenced with, but we'll get there.
Drake, he's gone through so much. He has put his entire career on the line to even say this, to bring this out. And this is before his big show. There's so much weighing on him. And now he's told his story. Brian Peck has been arrested and he walks into court and this is the day that he's supposed to get some justice for this.
I'm sure he's terrified. Like, even just walking into a courtroom is intimidating, especially as like a 15-year-old boy. And you just have no control. You're just like watching all of these adults fight over your trauma. Everyone's speaking for you. He doesn't speak, by the way. But when he walks in, Like we said, he had not told his dad what happened, so he's only there. Like, his side of the courtroom is only his mom and brother. And the other side of the courtroom, on Brian's side, is jam-packed full of people who are there to support him. People in the industry. Drake knew a lot of the people on the other side, and they did not know who the victim was until they walked in.
So what happens in this trial is that Brian, instead of taking it to trial fully for the 11 charges, what he does is he pleads no contest to two of the charges, two of the lesser charges. And so in that plea deal, they throw out the other charges, and ultimately he's sentenced to 16 months of prison, and he has to register as a sex offender. A number of the people who were there to support Brian Peck through this situation, numerous different famous celebrities who he's worked with in the past, all write letters of support for Brian Peck. And this is intended to influence his sentencing. They're trying to influence the judge to sentence him to an even lighter sentence. Many of them suggest that he should only receive probation for this.
They weren't released. They were sealed at the time. But they've since been released because of the documentary.
Mm-hmm. They had those court records released, and so all of those Drake letters didn't became available.
Drake didn't know who wrote letters of support. And mind you, like, they didn't know that he was a victim until they walked in. They only knew the story that whatever Brian had told them. So I'm not saying that's an excuse at all, especially as we get into this, it's still bullshit. Then come to find out later, these letters have even more people that Drake knew and had continued to work with. So later on, like, Drake had gone and done like movies and stuff with them, and they just acted like totally normal around him, even though they knew that they had written letters in this guy's defense and that Drake was the child who was abused in it. It's wild. So Drake's like trauma keeps being reopened over and over.
He says that his life after some of this is just a lot of it is some of it is a bit of a haze to him, and that some of this time was a bit of a haze to him as well. He says he remembers the abuse, but sometimes he doesn't remember much else. And the identities of the people who wrote these letters of support were not publicly available and wouldn't have been available to Drake at the time. But the documentary was able to get those letters unsealed, you know, because they were able to get access to the court documents. And so there were a lot of different famous people who wrote these letters, and they included people like James Marsden, Taron Killam, Alan Thicke, Tom DeSanto, the director of the X-Men movie, Ron Melendez, Ryder Strong, and Will Friedle from Boy Meets World, Joanna Kearns, Kimmy Robertson, and Rich Carell and Beth Carell. And Rich Carell and Beth Carell, in their letters, they talk about, I mean, all the letters talk about how great Brian Peck is and how he couldn't have possibly done all these things, or even that if he had, he must have been tempted so horribly to be convinced to doing these things because he's such a good person that he would never. And Rich Carell and Beth Carell both specifically talk about working with Brian Peck and how they'd like to work with Brian Peck again. And interestingly enough, those two went on to work for the Disney Channel and to make the show The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody. And they hired Brian Peck to work on that show years later, after he'd served his 16-month sentence. After he was a convicted sex offender who was a registered sex offender, he was still hired by Rich and Beth Carell to work on the set of The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody with children.
And the things that were written in these letters, it's like they knew that he was being accused of sexually assaulting a minor. They knew that. They didn't know the details and they didn't know who, but they knew enough to know that he was being accused of raping a child. And in these letters, they write things like, I'm sure that whoever the victim was tempted him so much that he just broke. He would never do this otherwise. He's such a good person. This must be a situation where he is being targeted. And it's just like, under any circumstance is, they don't even necessarily say it doesn't happen. They say that the child must have tempted him.
It's like this guy was manipulating and controlling the situation to have access to Drake. It's like, to look at it in that perspective is wild. You know what I mean? He really, they were all under his spell as well.
Which is why when Will Friedle and Ryder Strong come out on their own podcast to talk about this, it's sort of amazing that they have any sort of defense because they're just like, oh, well, we didn't know who it was. Well, it doesn't matter who it was. Any hint that a child tempted an adult, it doesn't matter who the victim is. That literally doesn't happen.
Yeah, they acted as though they didn't really have that much information about what happened, which...
I kind of want to talk about this podcast. I'm going to go on a rant about...
Yeah, you
want to
talk about the Pod Meets World that we listen to?
Yes, because like we were talking about everything canceled and it ruining everything from her childhoods, I was a huge Boy Meets World fan. I've seen every episode. I've said this on a lot of things. Ryder Strong specifically, I had his photo all over my wall. I loved him. And if you don't know and the names aren't connecting, Ryder Strong plays Sean on Boy Meets World, the heartthrob with the hair flip. And Will Friedle plays the older brother, Matt. So the two hot guys on the show, right? And I don't know to what capacity they know Drake before or after. It seems like they knew each other well enough that I think Drake kind of considered them to be friends enough that he was shocked that they were some of the people who wrote letters. But essentially, Will Friedle, Ryder Strong, and
Danielle Fishel,
they have their own podcast called Boy Meets Pod or Pod Meets World.
Pod Meets World, yeah.
Kind of a lame name. They should come up with a new name. I'm judging another podcast. So they do not reach out to Drake. They find out through whatever that their letters are going to be released. They know this is going to be a big fucking deal. It's going to be revealed that they wrote letters in Brian's defense. And they do not contact Drake and apologize. They don't do anything directly to handle the situation with Drake first. I mean, you're already kind of like, you should have done that years ago. But now they still aren't doing that now when they've been caught publicly.
Which is something that Josh Peck was accused of kind of when all this happened too. They're like, oh, well, why aren't you supporting Drake? And, you know, Josh Peck was getting kind of dragged a little bit as well. But Drake came out and said that, you know, Josh reached out to me personally. And
yeah, at least Josh.
That means a lot more to me than making a public statement. So
also, it seems
stop dragging him.
It also seems like Josh actually knew when they were kids that Drake had told Josh when they were kids on set that like he had kept that secret their whole lives. Anyways, they have this very like performative podcast, and it sucks that like I now don't like them because they were some of my favorite actors. And so like I'm sitting in that, right? We all have to process not defending the celebrities we love to any cost. Like I had to go through this with Cosby, and it is what it is. But they bring this therapist. So Danielle gets on and she's like, today is a very sensitive topic, and so we've brought on a therapist to help us talk and process. There's just this long-ass intro.
And they make it seem as though, because the podcast is about them going through the show episode by episode, I believe.
Yeah, this is like a totally different episode.
They make it seem as though they're like, well, we're getting to these episodes where this guy worked on them with us, so I guess we have to talk about him, and his name is Brian Peck. But they don't say specifically that also this documentary is about to come out that exposes them as being people who wrote letters of support for Brian Peck.
They're definitely trying to
oh, well, we're just getting to it here, so I guess we have to talk about it even though we don't want to.
They're trying to jump ahead so that their statements come out before the big reveal that they wrote letters in his defense. So yeah, so Danielle comes on, gives this like long intro, blah, 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 blah. Will Friedle kind of, I feel like he talks the most about it. And he basically plays, they both play it off like, we were really young. We only knew Brian's side. We didn't know who the victim was. Brian told us he was the victim and he was our friend. We had great experiences with him. All we did was just write these letters. And they do try to say like, now that we're older and we have children, they seem apologetic. They're just like, I wish I hadn't done that. It was wrong that they fucked up. They say they fucked up. But the truth is, counteract to that, one, they didn't talk to Drake. So that's super fucked up. Like, it just is. They should have just reached out to Drake and been like, I was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. Two, they weren't really that young. They were something like 27 and 24. They were not
at the time of the trial, right?
Yeah. Yeah. When they wrote these letters.
And that's something that Drake says when he's criticizing. He's like, you know, I appreciate some of the things they said, but they didn't talk to me. And also they kind of make it sound like when they wrote these letters, they were still teenagers. Like they were just kids who didn't know better. But by the time of the trial came around, these dudes were, they're grown ass men.
Yeah, they were definitely, like, if you don't know what raping a child is at 27, like, you couldn't use any discretion.
Or you're willing to make excuses for it.
And they do go on to say, like, a lot of this was normalized for them because in the industry, like, they had their own experiences with these adults hitting on them when they were teenagers, and they were very mm-hmm. sexualized as heartthrobs, and the adults around them, especially older women, would flirt on them. They went on to marry older women, and that all of this changed for them when they became fathers, and they would, you know, not let their kids be in the industry for these reasons. So they do a whole thing, you know, and I do give them credit in that they admit that they were wrong and that they should have just known better. But they definitely kind of turn themselves into victims and try to downplay it a bit. And the whole podcast, the whole time, they're like, we didn't want to do this podcast. This is so icky to talk about. It sucks. And like, I guess I get what they're saying. But it's also just like, so this is all a PR thing. You didn't actually want to do this. You don't actually want to talk to Drake and apologize. You don't actually want to like have important conversations about abuse in the industry. You are being forced into this because your letters are being revealed. You need a PR thing. If you don't say anything, you're definitely going to be canceled. And this is all to protect your image. And Drake calls them out on that. He like posts on his Twitter and was just kind of like, you still haven't apologized to me, like fuck you. So that's the big one. That's the tea on Will Friedle and or Friedel, I don't know how you say that, and Ryder Strong. And Danielle's like sort of an accomplice. Like she's the girl who goes on it as their apologist and is just like, these men are having, like, they're processing that they witnessed trauma and they are processing their own thing. And, like, I brought on the therapist and I think this is important and I'm going to help these men orchestrate this conversation. And it's just sort of like, dude, Danielle, like, there's a little boy that was raped. And did you call him? Did you tell these men to call them? Like, it sucks. It sucks. That's what they did.
If you were to follow the narrative of the documentary, we're a little out of order, because they set up the Brian Peck story by going a little bit back in time, not that much further before that, but they tell a story about another person who worked at Nickelodeon. And, well, they tell two stories, honestly, but one we're going to cover in detail and one we're going to cover very briefly about people who worked at Nickelodeon and the ways in which oversight over who was allowed to work on set at Nickelodeon and who specifically who is allowed to work with children was simply not as good as it should have been, because not only was Brian Peck allowed to work on set, there were two other pedophiles who were working at Nickelodeon at that time or before that time, like shortly before that time, who got access to their victims by working at Nickelodeon and who were convicted. The one story that is the most significant is told by the mother of one of the victims. She goes by MJ on the show, and her daughter is Brandy. This girl was 11 years old at the time that she was an extra on the Amanda show. And when she was an extra on the Amanda show, she came into contact with Jason Handy, because Jason Handy was a production assistant on the Amanda show. And if you remember what the job of a production assistant is that it's their job to kind of like make everything flow on set, as far as like particularly having the actors be in the right place at the right time. And so Jason Handy's job, kind of similar to Brian Peck, involved working one-on-one with the actors and the extras and the children on set often. That was something that he did all the time.
It's interesting when we talk about predators in Hollywood, because it's like, oh, why is Hollywood full of pedophiles? And I think it's, we often talk about how people who crave or abuse power, all of these careers, cops, teachers, priests, whatever, why are they all abusers? People who are seeking to abuse power, they seek out these positions where they are given, one, handed victims, people who work with children, and two, they're given this power that they're able to. So it's like, of course, we're going to see an increase of this type of abuse in these areas, because those type of abusers seek out those jobs. And then you have things like Hollywood, where we're handing children alone and vulnerable to these adults.
And Jason Handy really fits that profile of like I don't know. He fits the profile in so many ways. A lot of people who worked on these different sets worked with him. They all knew him. And so they describe him in a lot of different ways. They have a lot of experience with him. Everybody who worked on all that in the later years, they all worked with this guy, they say.
And he's kind of younger.
Yeah, he's a younger guy. They're like, he's a goofy white boy from Nebraska. They say he's real friendly and personable and jokey. He's always around. They specifically say, like, oh, he would join us for Bible study. Ultimately, this leads to Jason Handy coming into contact with Brandy when she is an extra on the Amanda Bynes show, or on the Amanda show. Her mom describes her as, you know, at the end of the show, they exchange emails. Jason's real friendly with this 11-year-old girl.
She's 11. I was going to say 9. She's 11.
11-year-old girl. And he says that, oh, you know, you'll have a friend in the industry. You know, this is she wants to be on more shows, you know. So it's like, oh, I'll have a friend with you. And this leads to them having like a friendly relationship where they're emailing back and forth.
And this is back when it's normal. This happened to
early 2000s. Yeah.
I went on a tour in New York once and my tour bus driver, I was also 11. At the end, like, he had been very friendly and charismatic and liked to talk to me about his trips. And at the end, when my mom wasn't standing there, he handed me his business card with his email. And he's like, why don't you email me? Because I'll send you pictures from my trips and stuff. And I like told my mom, like, oh my God, the bus driver gave me his email so I can talk to him about his traveling because I love to travel. And she's like, over my dead body, will you email this man? He is being a creep. Do not email him. But email was normal. Like, that would have been... It's not normal for an adult to email a child, but kind of. It wouldn't have been.
That was how you had pen pals at the time.
Yeah, that was how you communicated and shared.
Well, this leads to one day, Brandy gets an email from Jason, and MJ notices that she, after this email, she walks away from the computer and seems really upset, and she questions her about it. And what had happened was that Jason had sent a photo of him masturbating to this girl and something, I wanted you to see me because I'm thinking of you, some creep ass shit. And the mom, MJ, she says that she didn't know what to do. And she wasn't sure if she needs to call this person, you know, she doesn't know what to do. And this is why she's getting so much hate, is because she didn't
Yeah. Ending their communication, which it sounds like the little girl, at least the little girl didn't get wrapped up in it. It seemed like she was scared and didn't want to engage in that anymore. It wasn't, she hadn't been groomed enough in the sense that she, you know, tried to reply and engage in this. It scared her. Other than the mother shutting it down, communication, you know, don't message that man again, maybe watching her internet stuff after that, she did not call the police. She did not report him. She literally did fucking nothing, dude.
But what does happen is simultaneously to this taking place, Jason Handy is also corresponding with another girl that he met on the set of the Cousin Skeeter show. And this is a 9-year-old girl that he meets and befriends. And this all takes place around like the spring and summer of 2000. He befriends this girl in a similar way that he did to Brandy. They have like a friendly relationship, but this relationship goes a little bit further than the one with Brandy, where they're not just emailing, like they hang out, they spend time together, you know? And apparently what happens is one day Jason Handy is over at this little girl's house and they're playing video games in her bedroom. And he tries to kiss her and tries to force his tongue into her mouth and tells her not to tell her mom. But she does. And that leads to her going to the police. And that leads to an investigation into Jason Handy. And so they call Brandy's mom to find out, and they call everybody else. And
I think because they called the parents of people he had worked with, not because they knew about the emails.
Yeah. And they issue a search warrant for his house and they search his house. And at his house, they find a very large amount of child pornography on his personal computer. And in addition to that, they also find Ziploc bags that have tokens of items from young girls. And they describe some of the items. They have like letters from the girls. And he even has things like, he has a pair of underwear that is in a bag with a girl's name on it who's 7 years old.
Oh my,
he also has a very extensive diary that, I mean, he confesses everything in there, where he talks about how he's a pedophile. He says, I am a pedophile, full blown. And he even goes so far as to write about how he's thinking about how he could find a victim to rape if he feels like he needs to. And so...
Don't they find something of Brandy's?
One of the tokens that he has is stuff from Brandy. I can't remember. I think it's like letters or something.
Yeah, it's something not super like
it's
shocking.
Not her underwear, but he does have like other little girls' underwear. Like fucked up shit. And so he's convicted. Two felonies and a misdemeanor. And therefore, both cases, both this other little girl and the case with Brandy, they say that he never apologizes to the little girls. And similar to with what happened with Brian Peck, people who worked on the shows with him just describe him as the next day he was just gone. He was disappeared from set. And there's one other pedophile who also worked at Nickelodeon. And this is around, this is like a little bit after Brian Peck, but this is a guy who was apparently like he was a temp worker or like a freelancer who was hired by Nickelodeon. And supposedly Nickelodeon, they didn't do as much work as far as vetting the people who are freelancers who worked for them. And so they didn't do background checks on freelancers. And so this person who had a prior conviction as a sex offender, his name was Azel Channel, was hired by Nickelodeon. And he ended up meeting a young boy on set of a Nickelodeon show and abusing him on the Nickelodeon lot.
It just seems like, you know, they're everywhere. Even, you know, Matthew Underwood, which I can't remember what show he works on, but
he's Zoe 101, I think.
He came forward because people were really, specifically Alexa Nichols or Nicholas?
Alexa Nicholas.
Alexa Nicholas was really putting pressure on him to make a statement. I don't know if she had suspicions or, you know, specifically why she was putting so much pressure on him and a few others. But he finally came out on his Instagram and was just, okay, fine. Like, you all need to consider that some of us don't want to talk, not because we don't want to help victims or anything, but because we're processing our own shit. And, you know, Matthew Underwood comes out that he had been sexually abused by, I believe, his agent, someone within the industry that he, as a young teen, preteen, had also been sexually abused.
Yeah, he was abused by his agent as a teenager when he was 19. He said that he was abused younger. I think he was abused by a
family member as well.
Yeah, or like a friend's family member, and then being abused again as an older teenager, as a 19-year-old, by his former agent.
Yeah, and so like this documentary, obviously by its title, it's not the Drake documentary, it's not the Dan documentary. It's Quiet on Set. It's talking about how this is also a huge Hollywood problem. It's a problem in our homes. It's a problem in sports. It's a problem in churches. But it's also a huge problem in Hollywood. And so this is sort of bringing to light, how can we protect these kids? How can we make changes? Can we do better background checks? Can we do better investigations? How did Nickelodeon have so many fucking pedophiles on site? We've got to look at that. Who can be held responsible to some degree? What could these parents have done differently? What signs were there? Like, this is bringing up a lot that we need to talk about. If we're going to continue having children be actors and on these shows, we can't have a whole nother generation of this.
Yeah, it's the story of Drake, and it's the story of Brian Peck and all of these things, but it's really about the environment that was created by Nickelodeon. And really, it seems like this is a common environment on a lot of different sets, whether they're movie sets or television sets, and also going back historically, where there are children who are vulnerable, people's careers are on the line, and then it's people who have power who are able to exploit them, and they're able to use their positions to do horrible things, you know, unspeakable things. And then beyond that, it seems as though there's this entire environment and this entire system that is there to support them as far as like continuing having careers. And it really seems as though you either get with it or you get kicked out the other end.
Right. There's sexual abuse and power abuse everywhere. So when we talk about child abusers, it's like, okay, well, like, where do you get children for this? Where do you get children to make child porn? Where do you get children to abuse for yourself? And it just makes sense that you would find child actors on set. You're going to be handed the position to be with all these people. And like I said, the other documentary, Open Secret, there's a whole thing where these kids are taking headshots. They have to take headshots. They have to take all of these pictures for their auditions and to send to people. And there's specifically an agent that they talk about who's a manager agent for children. But he also, conveniently on the side, is also a photographer who takes these headshots. And one day this mom discovers that her kids' headshots are being sold on eBay. And she's just like, why are my kids' headshots being sold? And I don't even think her brain automatically goes to like, child molesters must be buying these headshots. But at first she's just like, why would they sell for $90?
And like, a lot of the photos are not just headshots. Yeah, that's another thing. Shirtless photos.
Think about like specifically the images in my head of these pictures are like, imagine the 90s, 2000s where like they showed young boys are in the pictures. Well, and it's like,
do you remember the Calvin Klein ads with Bijou Phillips?
Yeah, it's very similar, but
criticized for the same thing. I remember these photos looked very similar to that, where there are these photos of shirtless young boys and at the same angle where it's like this down angle of them like sitting. It's,
well, what really I was gonna say is
similar,
like,
similar imagery.
Speaking on the style of the time, it's like in the early 2000s, I just remember the pictures of the boys that were on there, and they have like button down Hawaiian shirts open with those like white puka shells around their neck. Mm-hmm. Remember when that was like popular?
And so
when I looked at the pictures, like, because I'm not a pedophile, I looked at it, I was like, oh, I remember when all that was in style.
Totally.
And like, I live in California, it's hot, boys walk around without shirts all the time, that's very normal. So I looked at the picture, I was like, oh, that would actually, if I was a parent at the time and someone's taking a picture of my son and his shirt was undone and it's like a Hawaiian shirt and he looks like he's a California kid in the summer with his little puka shells and long hair, I don't know if I would have been like, oh, you're taking a picture of my kid shirtless from this angle. I can see how the pictures came to be and how a mom wouldn't have been immediately suspicious. Had it been a girl with an unbuttoned shirt, that would have been different, but it was a boy.
I think it's interesting the way in which these abusers and people who are very much bad intentioned are able to launder those intentions through supposedly like having good intentions.
Yeah, they walk that line between what's normal and what's not.
The same way that Brian Peck was able to hide behind identifying as being openly gay, it's also the same situation with Dan and the type of environment that they had on his shows on set, where it's like, oh, we joke around, this is really fun. And it's like, on one level, like, oh, that seems really cool. Don't you want to work in a workplace environment where people have fun and joke around and are like candid with each other like that? They seem to get along. But then that is an environment in which they're able to launder this type of behavior that is perverted and goes as far as child molestation.
Right. So like I said, it kind of walks that line of normal for this boy to have a button down shirt. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so this mom finds, why is my kid's headshots? And she starts discovering all these other kids' headshots that are selling for insane amounts. Also consider the time and inflation. We're talking about the year 2000 or whatever.
Yeah,
these
pictures eBay. We're talking to eBay.
And we're talking like $100 for a kid's headshot set.
I remember like $300 for some of them.
Yeah.
Know, like a lot
so,
of money.
So she starts her own investigation, which now it looks like she kind of has her own foundation for protecting child actors. So obviously this became like her mission. And she starts watching the sellers. Who's selling these things? Who's bidding on them? And she starts tracking these names, and she finds one in particular that just keeps popping up as a seller, and she like takes the screen name and she starts tracking it. She like figured it out.
Some connection where she was able to put it together.
She was able to like put it together that it's her own kid's agent. The guy who took the photos and the guy who's getting her kid jobs is taking those headshots of her son and these other kids and selling them to other child molesters. The things that we're told are just, you know, exaggerations of sex trafficking and not what it really looks like. Wayfair shit. This is an example of one of those times where it's like, this is what was happening.
Of that taking place, yeah. At least. Yeah.
And so she figures that out. And so anyways, this is how like the industry is infiltrated with pedophiles and abusers, is because there's all these little types of opportunities for every type of pedophile. The ones that want child pictures and child porn, ones that want children for themselves, ones that want young kids, ones that want teenagers. It's giving a lot of opportunities for all these types of abuses. And so I think that's why like Hollywood is getting this label as like Hollywood pedos, and people are going as far as satanic whatever. well, there is a real problem here. And it,
yeah,
and it,
let's
but
look
it,
at what we can see for sure.
But
know?
It's logical. Like I said, the math, this is a great opportunity and place for an abuser to go find children. And also, like, I'm not sure if I mentioned this on the last podcast, but when we talk about Dan Schneider and the scenes that he was doing with the kids that are really sexual, and a lot of people are trying to be like, it wasn't even sexual, like, your mind is in the gutter. You know what is really telling is how when you go on YouTube and you look up these clips, and people are posting the clips now to try to reference this documentary and things, but when you go and look at these clips and you look at the comments, there are hundreds of really creepy old dudes calling them hot. He made child porn for people who want to watch it out there, who maybe don't want to download real child porn and go to jail. And you can tell that he hit the marker for these pedophiles. It was probably a type of video that he enjoyed himself. He knew what he was doing, and he was making it for other creepy people to watch. And you can see that in those comments. There are a lot of creepy men.
It's just another example of that kind of process that we're just talking about, where it's like, oh, well, that's just Dan's humor, right? And Dan's humor is this often like this really like absurdist type of humor. I think it's interesting because things that are really absurd and off the wall like that, I do think are really funny. Like even in like the Amanda's hot tub sketch or Amanda's jacuzzi sketch, it's like, are we going to eat spaghetti in the hot tub now? Yeah, let's eat some spaghetti. You know, while that's a weird sketch, and so that seems weird in context, like, it's, you know, it's that's just weird and funny outside of any sort of weird sexual context, like eating spaghetti in a hot tub. That's definitely like Dan's type of humor. But then again, he's able to use this humor to launder the perverted type of things that we talked about in the last episode, the goo face scenes and all of this other stuff. You're using something that's funny, you know what I mean? But you're using it to hide something that is, then it becomes really disturbing and unsettling when you're using that to hide basically like abuse or perverted images or things that are maybe even intended to show off these girls' bodies or things like that.
My take on this is, let's just say Dan is completely innocent and he meant nothing by this, and our minds are just in the gutter and he wasn't being gross. And maybe there's just creepy people out there.
Which would be a crazy argument to make, but we can make it for that point.
Let's say, like, best case scenario, Dan's not the creep, right? Well, when we talk about protecting these kids, part of protecting them is knowing that there's creeps out there who will sexualize these things. Mm-hmm. And so you have to err on the safe side.
Totally.
If you know, I mean, okay, I know that they didn't really know YouTube was going to be what it was, but if you know that there's going to be a pedophile sitting at home who doesn't want to get in trouble for downloading his own child porn, well, what's your best next option? Let's turn on a kids show. When they go and raid, you know, a pedophile's home, like, things that they find in there are like catalogs for kids' clothes, or they find in their search engine that they're looking at, like, the bathing suit ads for kids. There's ways around it, and one of those ways around it is going and looking at those clips of the Nickelodeon shows, and you see the creepy dudes in the comments who are getting off on it, and it's like, that right there, that's what you had to protect them from, Dan. So if you aren't the creep, how could you exploit them and make material out of these kids for creeps?
Most people who are trying to protect children are going to think about those things.
Yeah, it's not that we are so perverted that we're seeing it as sexual. It's that we're seeing it from like a protective lens of like, this could be taken that way, and we have to protect our kids from that. But it's like, at some point, did an audience of pedophiles figure out that they get this stuff from Nickelodeon and they kept coming back? Did he have an ongoing audience who knew that they could get this kind of material from him? Because that's what it looks like.
Fine. I mean, I'm sure that that was part of the audience for these shows.
Yeah, it really seems like it. And the creepy uncle in the room is the entire world watching from the TV. You have invited the pedophile into the room by putting them on TV for anyone to see. So they aren't just being viewed by kids. They're not. So anyways, that is the Drake story. That is the Hollywood Drake story.
Well, that's basically the story of Brian Peck and Drake Bell, but
I'm going to bring on a part two episode of this, which will, I guess, will be part three of the Nickelodeon series.
We have a lot more to talk about as far as how the rest of Drake Bell's career played out and what happened with him as far as his own cancellation story that comes up after this.
Yeah, so part three will be Drake's cancellation. And I'm actually envisioning a part four and a part five. I would like to do a deep dive on the Open Secret documentary eventually. And I think we're going to have an episode entirely about Amanda Bynes.
So stay tuned for that stuff coming up.
And the next episode of Quiet on Set comes out tomorrow at the time of recording this. And so we may have some extra material to bring in on that as well. So
thanks for listening. We've been appreciating all of the listeners out there listening to this podcast.
Doing things like rating us, sharing us, downloading, please following us.
Follow us on Instagram. Rate us on wherever you're listening to us.
5 stars are nothing. 5 stars are bust, please. Thank you.
We love to hear if you have ideas for future podcasts. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of ideas. The list is very long, but we will absolutely add to it if you give a good one for us.
Especially if you have new current news or gossip, we bring it to us.
Yeah, but absolutely.
I am specifically going to address one person's comment that came into our feed in the next episode. So I'm excited to address that.
You'll be hearing it from Lorena, whoever you are.
Good news is we do have a shop up.
Everythingscanceled.myshopify.com is our merch store.
We've got some Everything's Canceled stuff. We've got some...
We've been hard at work coming up with some ideas. If you have any ideas for that one, shoot us too. Have you got any good merch ideas? I think we have too many, but
merging,
we'll have a lot more.
Merging our ideas or fighting over whose designs are better has been interesting. But I'm trying to get some like Cancel Scientology up, Save Amanda Bynes stuff up. And I want to get some stuff for our characters, Lorena Bobbitt and Pee Wee Herman. There's some pins in there, some cancel culture merch. Check it out. That would really support us here.
Yeah, that's the best way to support us for sure. We're definitely going to be expanding this podcast. We're going to try and make these episodes as regular as possible, and so that we're coming back to you on a regular basis. We got a lot in the works, so please stay tuned. Please follow and stick with us. We got a lot more to talk about. We got a whole lot more to say.
All right. We will catch you in the next episode where we are going to talk about Drake being canceled before he came on this documentary.
Yeah, there's definitely more to the Drake Bell story.
All right. Bye, Herman.
Bye.
Ooh, how about a music video?
Yes.
Of your band?
Yes.
And I'll direct it. Maybe.